IsraelSin.com.
We've had some time to think about the different subjects we covered last week when we went really fast and really deep through Commandments 6 through 9. And I understand that what we've done with this course up till now has been really, I mean, it's either really very revolutionary or it's quite misleading. Okay, one or the other. Because beforehand, we had the Ten Commandments. It was, you know, as I said in the very first session, we said that the Ten Commandments are on the synagogue walls. They're a symbol that everybody recognizes, and yet as a set of 10 important statements about life, about the universe, about our human world, they're kind of lost. Right? That's what we said at the beginning. And I put forth a hypothesis which said that maybe these 10 commandments aren't simply mitzvot, aren't simply legal statements, ancient legal statements of questionable immediacy, questionable relevance for our age, but really it's 10 big things. And that was the hypothesis I put out to you. Now, what I didn't really say is that such a statement is actually kind of revolutionary. That is to say, there haven't been an awful lot of attempts, at least not in the last, say, 50 years, 100 years, to try, at least from a traditional Jewish perspective, to try to get behind the meaning of the Ten Commandments as 10 big, important statements. And if I succeed, if I'm right, even if I'm only half right, even if I'm right that it's 10 big statements and the other half, which is what the statements are, maybe I'm wrong about that, even if I'm only right about the first half, it's a big deal. Okay, it's a big deal for all of us. It opens a discussion that has to be had, which is why this last 10th commandment makes me so nervous. Because the 10th commandment is not at all, obviously, doesn't fit very well into this this idea of these 10 big statements. But I will go out on a limb and call this class Session 5, The Source of Evil in Our World. These are the 9 commandments we've had up till now. Opening commandment with redemption, the idea that each and every person has an ability and a duty to intervene in our world. We pointed out how this is not simply the first commandment, but really the overarching theme, and that this distinguishes the Hebraic biblical tradition from other ancient traditions and from other modern traditions. We went through morality, integrity, and affirming the self, and wisdom as 4 major values or goals, more appropriately. Life, love, freedom, and community, we all covered those last week. And my claim is that when we get done with this evening, we're going to understand that the 10th commandment is not simply a trivial statement about coveting, as we usually think, but it's really fundamentally about the kind of spirit you need, the kind of spiritual disposition you need in order to be able to achieve the entire vision of the 10 commandments. When you reach the top of a mountain, the peak looks very, very small. First, I want to take a little step back and share with you something I came across this past week. It's a verse in Proverbs. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. I'm bringing this in partly because, if you remember, the issue of the self was very, very crucial, right? It was the central theme in the fourth commandment, the Sabbath. And in many ways, this idea of the great invested self reflected in the image of the shepherd, right? Throughout the Bible, the image of the shepherd. This was in many ways the pivot upon which the entire vision of the Ten Commandments, the entire redemptive vision turns. It's what distinguishes the Hebrew Bible, in my mind, from, for example, the New Testament. Distinguishes Jewish teachings of the self from traditional Christian teachings of the self, which is about negating the self, about turning yourself into a vessel for grace, right, for the divine grace to come through you and to go out into the world by canceling the self? And I claim no. In the Hebraic tradition, in the ancient Israelite tradition, the self is something that needs to be big and strong so that you can expand. And that every one of these other commandments, these other great statements, were about that expansion, how it works, about love and about property, okay, and about community. So I want to share with you something I came across about this verse. Rabbi Moshe Shapira, one of the great Orthodox rabbis of the last century, wrote this about the verse. Very few people feel their own feelings, think their own thoughts, love what they themselves love, distance what they themselves distance. Most people do not own themselves. In one matter, they fulfill the obligations of one person, and in another matter, the obligations of a different person. They do one thing because it appears correct in the eyes of one person, and withhold from doing another thing so as not to anger a different person. They think one way because someone said something, and they love another thing because yet another person said something else. Essentially, the self of every person is a great assembly of other people, a public domain, a breached city. The only thing missing is he. I'm not making this stuff up. Okay, this is something that ties very, very deeply into the depths of our tradition. It's a reading of the biblical text, but it has an awful lot of echoes throughout the rabbinic tradition as well. A reader, please, with verve.
With verve?
Verve.
You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant.
Oops, I spelled, wow.
His ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's.
I was in a big hurry. It was a big, no accident, no accident. The Freudian 10th commandment slip. All right. Hang on. But I'm a crazy perfectionist, so I'm going to fix it as we speak. Watch this.
Rightly so.
Rightly so. Thank you. I appreciate that appreciation.
Well, that's a lot of depth.
Okay. I'm happy with that. Let's go there. Okay, there we go. This commandment looks on the face of it like something trivial. It's a difficult commandment to deal with. We can take it in one direction and say, you know, with the New Testament, basically it's saying that all the things that you do, really if you feel them, just thinking them and feeling them, if you want to, you know, stealing isn't the only bad thing, coveting is bad. You know, committing adultery isn't the only bad thing, but having lust in your heart for another man's wife, that's the bad thing. And it's just about saying all those bad things we talked about doing, you know, even if you just think them, they're bad too.
What's the word in Hebrew
that they use?
Covet.
Lo tachmod. Tachmod.
Something else than covet?
Probably not. We say that a child is chamud, right? He's a sweetie. I covet him. He's covetable. Okay? Eretz chemdat avot, right? The land that our forefathers longed for. Covet. I want to get back, double back to that. First, I want to understand what's going on here. We have a theoretical claim about how to read these texts. And that claim is that they're to be read paradigmatically. Right? That was the claim. That's the methodology we're using to read the Ten Commandments. So the question we need to ask is, what is this the paradigmatic case of? Pardon my ending the question with a preposition. Of what? Okay? Let's take a look. There are a few clues here. There's a literary clue I'd like to point to. In what other commandment have we seen this list? Seen a kind of a list?
Shabbat,
right? The fourth commandment. Neither you nor your manservant nor your maidservant, your ox, and so forth. Okay, there's a literary echo here of Shabbat. Okay? So, literary clue number one, there's a connection to Shabbat. Shabbat, we understood, was about the self, about the affirmation of the self. Something here is going on that's affirming the self. Literary clue number two is that, as we mentioned this before, I mentioned this last time, what other commandment has no action? The first one, right? The first one, I am the Lord your God. Right? It doesn't say do this or don't do that. It just says, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. So we have a connection to the first commandment, kind of like a bookend kind of image of...
Why? This is thou shalt not, you shall not.
That's true.
But it's not I'm demanding
it. It's demanding something of you, but it's not demanding an action. It's demanding something spiritual. It's demanding a certain kind of an attitude or disposition, which is what we understood the first commandment to be as well. So we have a connection back to the first commandment, as well as a connection to the fourth commandment about the self. What is this a paradigmatic example of? What makes you covet? What does it mean to covet?
Satisfaction.
Dissatisfaction with what?
Yourself.
Okay, there's a certain something I don't like about myself. That's something that's bothering me about myself. Yeah?
But also the inability to accept things that are different at your neighbors, always measuring yourself against your neighbor.
Why do people do that?
Because they're insecure.
Because they're insecure. Insecure. What a lovely word. Insecure. We talk about insecurity a lot, and somebody is going to accuse me, I predict, of being anachronistic and modern and over-focused on, you know, modern kind of anxieties and psychological analyses. But there is something interesting here about the statement insecurity, because when we talk about insecurity, you know, it's almost like we have two completely different discourses. We have the discourse of right and wrong, that we say, you know, you should do that, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't murder. And we have this other discourse of sort of the psychological analysis of other people that we do all the time. And the word insecure carries a very, let's call it a clinical kind of feel to it. It's a failing, but it's a failing that's part of this mechanism that's not so different from saying that somebody has, you know, malaria. Okay, that's a bad example. Somebody has an iron deficiency. Okay, this person's insecure. They need to go to a kind of a doctor and have it taken care of so that they'll be healthy. That's how we usually talk about insecurity. But I think that insecurity really does appear throughout the Bible as a very important issue. And not as a separate clinical thing, but as an actual moral issue. And I'm going to give you two huge examples of what I'm talking about. The first example is the story of the Exodus. Okay, the story of the Exodus, meaning not just leaving Egypt, but leaving Egypt, going to Mount Sinai, and all of these stories, this whole cycle of lots and lots of stories about the Israelites in the desert, have within them this really amazing, constant, recurring theme, which is the crying of the Israelites in the desert. Okay, and I don't know if you've ever really given thought to the question of what's it all doing there. Okay, we'll talk about a few of these stories, but as soon as you, it's one of these things that you don't necessarily notice it until you notice it, and then you can't see anything else. Over and over and over again, right, you have stories of the Israelites crying to Moses. Okay, this is early on, right, their backs are against the Red Sea, they haven't even gone into the Sinai area yet. They hadn't gotten the Ten Commandments. Their backs are against the Red Sea. The armies of Pharaoh are bearing down upon them. They have just witnessed 10 huge plagues Okay, if anything would convince them of the miraculous nature of what they're going through, they really ought to have been quite convinced. And yet, what do they say? And they said to Moses, in what is probably the most powerful example of sarcasm in the five books of Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Is not this the thing we did tell you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve Egypt'? For it had been better for us to serve Egypt than we should die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." Okay, this is not a smiley, fatherly, "Have no fear, the Lord is here." No. Okay? This is, "God's going to take care of this. Shut up." Okay? And what happens? The Red Sea parts. Okay, now you have to remember that before it happened, it had never happened before. So nobody actually had ever heard of the Red Sea parting until the Red Sea parted. It was really very miraculous. They crossed the riverbed, the seabed. Okay, the Red Sea crashes shut, destroying the enemy. And that holds them for what? 3 days? Okay.
Okay.
They get to a spring, the water is bitter, God miraculously sweetens it, they complain.
But it works.
It works. They shut up.
When they complain, they get what
they want. Yeah, another month and a half go by.
Well, they don't really get what they want.
We'll see if they get what they want. We'll see. We'll see where this leads in the end. Another month and a half go by. "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Okay, Moses doesn't like it. He gets angry. God gets angry. Okay, we will see that twice God gets very, very angry and threatens to destroy them, and Moses has to talk him out of it. There's a lot of inner politics, right, between, you know, it's sort of like an out-of-control academic department. Right, where like God is like the chairman, and he's like, "I'm gonna fire them all," and like, you know, this leading scholar says, no, because all the other academics, the other institutions are gonna say that you only took them out of Egypt to kill them in the desert. It's really a fascinating thing on its own. But the main story is that these Israelites are falling apart over and over again. There's something they're not getting, and Moses and God get increasingly angry at them. Anger is a moral anger. The assumption here is that their insecurity is a moral failing.
They've been slaves for so long.
Okay. Well, this is very much a part of the issue. They've been slaves for so long. And the undercurrent of the story, the really fascinating thing of the story, is God gave the Israelites the opportunity to leave their situation of slavery and embrace freedom. And they, over and over and over again, fail to do it. One of my favorite stories, I mean, this goes out of, I'm slightly going out of order because it's just quite unbelievable, is the story of Korach. Remember the story of Korach? Right, there's this alternate leader, this sort of attempted coup in the desert. Korach, and his followers, a couple hundred followers, they say, you know, "We're all holy. Everybody's holy. Why do you put yourself above everybody?" Moses says, "Hey, no problem. Whoever's right, you know, take your incense thing, and whoever's right, God's going to accept this, and God's going to accept. Whoever's wrong, we'll see what happens." Next morning, they all get together. God opens up the ground, swallows up all the bad guys. Pretty darn miraculous. What happens the next morning? What you expect, of course, is that everyone will say, "Wow, we're so sorry, Moses. You know, we're with you now." No.
We have doubted you.
Instead they say, "You killed the people of the Lord." Okay? So God gets really mad and sends a plague out throughout the Israelites, kills 14,700 people, and then they do it again. right? They say, Moses says, okay, Aaron is going to go out in the morning with his staff, and all the leaders of the other tribes are going to go out with their staffs, staves, whatever the plural of staff is. And they go out in the morning, and Aaron's is like got flowers all over it, theirs don't. And Moses says, or rather, God says to Moses, tell Aaron to do this, that there may be an end to their murmurings against me. And what happens? What do the Israelites say? Behold, we die. Everyone that comes at all near the tabernacle of the Lord dies. Shall we totally perish? Total, complete collapse, spiritual panic. Now what's interesting here, in this particular example, is that they accidentally unveil the thing that they're most afraid of. It's not Moses. It's not Aaron. It's the tabernacle. Right? What did we learn about the tabernacle? Another literary clue here. The tabernacle. The Mishkan. The place where? What? Where the Ten Commandments, the two tablets, are kept in the Holy of Holies, in the Ark. The place where, what else did we learn about it? Where the definition of investing in the self and affirming the self, the Sabbath, right? The laws of the work, you shall do no labor, is all connected to the tabernacle, the work that was done in the tabernacle. Okay? The whole concept of the redemptive self is bound up, the strong self is bound up in what's going on deep inside the tabernacle. And that's the thing they don't want to see. That's the thing that they say threatens their life. Because what's threatening their life is the assertion that they have to change. The assertion that they have a duty to overcome their insecurities. Now, of course, the ultimate story of their insecurity, the one that really results in the biggest, you know, has the biggest impact, is the sin of the spies. The sin of the spies. Okay, the sin of the spies. At a certain point, Moses turns to, God tells Moses to send 12 spies into the land of Israel, into the land that they're supposed to conquer. Right? They've only been out there for a couple of months. It says, send the head of each tribe into the land of Israel. It wasn't called the land of Israel then. Into the land, into Canaan, into the land of the seven nations. The land. I'm pointing there, but it's more here, right? Go in there. We're preparing to invade, you see. So we need
information.
We need reconnaissance. Okay, we need people to go in there and reconnoiter the land. Tell us what what the fortifications are like, what the defenses of the enemies are like. Tell us all this and get back to us. And the problem is that things don't really go as planned. Here's what they say. They come back, and here's what they say. We came to the land where you did send us, and indeed, it flows with milk and honey. And this is the fruit of it. Right? They came back, this famous picture of the Ministry of Tourism's logo, right? Right? Is that. Except for one thing, that this is not a happy story, as we shall soon find out. But the people are strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are fortified and very great. We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they spread an evil report of the land that they had spied out to the children of Israel, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that eats up its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are men of great stature, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers. And so we were in their sight. And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return to Egypt? The same thing, right? It's like a thread coming through the entire books of Exodus and Numbers. Is this theme of the Israelites saying, why'd you bring us out here? Why'd you do it? Why don't we just go back? It was just so great in Egypt. They don't have the guts to say, first of all, what was in Egypt was terrible. And where we're going is much better. They're afraid.
No, but even if it wasn't much better, the fact is that they've never taken responsibility for themselves.
They have never taken responsibility.
Ever.
But that's exactly what they don't want to do.
Wow.
That's what they don't want to do. That's what they had in Egypt. The thing that made them feel so good in Egypt was that they didn't have to take responsibility for themselves. And if some of them died and the rest of them worked horrible, you know, nasty hours,
victimization is cool.
It was the self, right? It was the self-affirmation of me as a victim. We're going to get deeper into that.
Just saying the devil that you know is better than the devil that you don't know.
That's part of it. Okay? That's part of it. But here, the devil that they don't know is themselves.
So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
When they were in Egypt, they worshipped God, right?
Unclear.
It's not clear. Okay.
Unclear.
Because it sounds like they don't believe him. They don't.
Well, they definitely need a lot of miracles to shore up their belief, mm-hmm. their confidence.
Still not enough.
Okay. But it's unclear. Okay. According to rabbinic tradition, only a tenth of them actually left. And the rest stayed behind. Okay. That the whole purpose of the painting the doorpost with the lamb's blood was to force the Israelites to do something active to assert their belonging to the rest of this group, okay? What happens? What's the result of this? Oh, by the way, before we get to the punishment, God freaks out again. God says, Moses, get out of the way. I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to remake you as the new people. And Moses says, don't do it. Talks God out of his tree, as it were. Okay, basically says, and it's very often does this with like a political, like a realpolitik argument. He says, think about your image, right? God, think about what other nations are going to say. They're going to say, you took them out of Egypt just to kill them all in the desert. How's that going to look? Okay, and it works. And God says, you know what? Okay, you're right.
You want to get elected next time.
You want to get elected, right? Right, divine election coming up. Okay. This happens twice. Once here, exact same thing. God wants to kill them all. Happens twice. Once here, where was the other time?
The golden calf.
The episode of the golden calf. Again, watch these literary connections across the Bible. You see the same thing happening in two completely different contexts. There's a connection. Look for that deeper connection. Okay, what it's saying is that what they're doing here is as morally problematic as the repudiation of God. The repudiation of themselves. What's the punishment? Your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness, and all that were numbered of you, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, who have murmured against me, shall by no means come into the land. But your little ones, who you said should be a prey, them I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your backsliding until your carcasses be consumed in the wilderness. Not a happy day.
What is backsliding?
What is backsliding? Well, that's a good question. What is backsliding? Why are they backsliding? In English, it means that they're reverting to something that they used to be that was bad. Okay, they have come out of something. Now they're going back to it. What are they going back to?
Worshipping idols.
Worshipping idols, the connection to the golden calf. But here, what are they going back to? In this case, they're going back to slavery. The refusal to assert themselves, individually and collectively. The refusal to believe in themselves.
Children having to bear their parents'
being goatee,
and they want to go forward
and be. Perhaps. If you want to put a nice little Zionist twist on it, sure.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I can do that. Where have we seen the punishment? This should be familiar. This punishment, something about carcasses, about people dying without proper burial and honor. Does this ring a bell? Did we see this last week? Who got that punishment last week? Somebody was, I'll give you another hint. their blood was going to be licked up by dogs. Ahab. Right, Ahab. King Ahab. What was his sin? What did he do wrong? He coveted. Oh, boy, did he covet.
Yes, he murdered.
Okay. He murdered, but lots of people murder. He murdered and took possession.
Right.
Okay, he dehumanized more so than just murder. He reduced Navot to the level of a, you know, something in the way of his getting more stuff. Okay? He denied Navot's right to possess, and in doing so, his right to be a redemptive self. That's what we talked about last week. He dehumanized him. So his punishment was the punishment of ultimate dehumanization. And that's what's going on here too. You dehumanize yourselves. You reject your own right and obligation to be selves, to take responsibility, to expand, to be strong. Then I'm going to show you symbolically, through a symbolic punishment, what you really look like. You look like carcasses rotting in the desert. That's what you look like. Okay? You do something, and again, we said this over and over again throughout this whole course. Punishments in the Torah are symbolic, in the whole Bible, are very, very often symbolic. Need to be understood not as a range of, you know, mild to severe, but as a symbolic statement that reflects the nature of the crime itself. Let me ask you something. Can you think of another story, one that we haven't really spoken about, in which someone's punished by wandering for the rest of their lives? Cain, right? Cain. The story of Cain and Abel. We have to talk about Cain and Abel. That's our second big story. But first, just want to wrap this up a little bit. The whole books of Exodus and Numbers, those two books, and quite a bit of Leviticus in between, okay, the whole midsection of the five books of Moses is about this. It's about the Israelites attempting to leave Egypt, not just physically, but above all spiritually. Theologically, in terms of idols, but internally, spiritually, going from slavery to being able to assert themselves and build themselves and be strong, strong enough to go in and create their own vision of a society, their own nation. And what we learn here is that this particular sin, the sin of the spies, the sin where instead of just going and getting reconnaissance, they come and they completely deflate the spirits of the people, that sin was so bad that it made God say, that's it, I've had it. I can't kill you all. Moses is right. It'll look bad. So instead, I'm just going to take my time. I'm God. I have time. I'm going to take my time. You guys are going to die out. And hopefully, the next generation will be something different. They'll have the ability to really assert themselves. Yeah?
Was there ever any comment by the rabbis about the fact that, in a sense, this was punishing...
Collective punishment.
Yes, because you don't know. I mean, there were people with big mouths, and they complained, but that doesn't mean that every single member of the tribe felt the same way. It wasn't like there were elections.
I've left out a small part of the story, okay, just for to keep it concise, and that part is that there were two of the 12 spies who disagreed. Okay, Caleb ben Yefune, and of course, Joshua, right? And these two sort of, you know, minority voices spoke their opinions, and as a result, those two were the only two people who were allowed to go into the land. Okay, and so there is a sense that the punishment is not collective. The punishment is universal because the crime is universal. Okay, that the people, and what we understand from the story, the people simply accepted what they said, and they lost faith, they lost their spirit. They had their leaders. Okay, maybe they had their own suspicions all along. As long as Moses was there and the leaders were with them, they were okay with it. As soon as their own tribal leaders said, forget it, he's completely out to lunch, they went along with it. That's what we understand from the story. So at least we have one huge story in the Torah that says spiritual deflation is a moral failing. It's not just a clinical problem. Insecurity is a problem that shines out beyond just health. It's a moral problem. The story of Cain and Abel on the face of it, looks like a radically different story, right? It's not the Israelites, it's just two people. It's not, you know, wandering in the desert and you know, complaining all the time. It's a murder. On the face of it, looks like two radically different stories, right? On the other hand, as somebody just pointed out, for some reason, the punishments are very, very similar. Let's just talk about it a little bit again. Cain and Abel are, of course, the first human beings outside, you know, the first normal human beings, the first people who were born, okay? Not just like zapped into being, right, by the Creator, right? We have the story of Adam and Eve, and they do what they do, and then, puff, they're kicked out, and they decide to raise a family. They have two boys, Cain and Abel. The first professions, right? Cain is a farmer. Abel is a shepherd. Ding, 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 ding. Raise that flag. Keep those eyes open for what shepherds do and how they respond to. But there's something else about this story that's very, very important, which is that the story of Cain and Abel is the first time in the Bible that the word sin is mentioned. First time. Now you might say, well, you don't need to mention the word sin because we saw that Adam and Eve and the apple and the original sin, and I'll double back to that a little bit later on. But for some reason, the first time the word sin appears in the Bible is not there, but here, Cain and Abel. So, we all know, right, know the story of Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel bring a sacrifice to God. Cain brings his vegetables. Abel brings his sheep. For some reason, God accepts Abel's sacrifice. Now, that some reason could be, as the rabbis said, because if you read it very closely, you'll see that Cain brought
the best.
That Abel brought the best. Abel brought the best of his flocks, and Cain brought some vegetables. You can read it that way. You can read it another way, which is that God likes shepherds more because of who they are. Okay? Or you could just read it in a very simple, carnivorous way, which is God likes the smell of meat.
Abel then was the first shepherd.
Abel was the first shepherd. That's right. He was the first shepherd before Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the 12 tribes, before Moses, before King David, before Rabbi Akiva. Right? The first one, the father of all shepherds, was Abel. Cain is very upset. He does not like this at all. Okay, it's not the last time we're going to see the story of one son being preferred over another son, and you know, and fights that ensue. Right, this coming week's weekly reading is about Jacob and Yaakov and Esav. Right, Jacob and Esau, with that whole thing. There's a recurring theme throughout the Torah of brothers. You know, one the younger one sort of getting around the older one. But there's a very, very funny line here. Very strange. I hope it's here. Let's see. Yes. Before the crime happens, God turns to Cain and says something very bizarre, which in Hebrew is even more bizarre. This is a translation. The Hebrew text is tight, it's dense, and it's almost deliberately mysterious sounding. And it translates as follows. Why are you angry? God says to Cain. Why are you crestfallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not, sin crouches at the door, and to you will its desire be, but you may rule over it. That statement sits there. It echoes. It reverberates through the text. We don't know what it means just yet. All we know is the very next thing that Cain does is he rises up, he goes out into the field, brings his brother out into the field, and he slays him. I want to double back to this in just a minute, but let's just finish out the story. You know what? No, let's not finish out the story. I'll finish it out in a minute. Let's talk about this. What is going on in this story? Before we get to the punishment, what's going on here? What is God saying to Cain? And how is Cain's response, what is that response that he goes up and he kills his brother? Someone explain this to me, because it's so tight, so dense, and yet we feel like it's very important, right? Right, there's a sense here that something really momentous has happened in the story.
God is warning him that if you don't accept what's going on, covet, in this case, the position that your brother has, you're going to end up sinning, and it's going to be your downfall. You're going to end up sinning, which means you're going to end up doing something you'll regret.
Okay, yeah?
I think it's just God telling him, like, why are you being insecure? Like, if you do this, this will happen. And if you do sin, you're in control of it. I mean, you're a free person. If he comes, then you can ignore it or do what you want and be your own person. Mm-hmm. And then he doesn't listen, and his insecurities take him over, and then he sins.
Okay. Okay. Did you ask anything else, Steve? Okay. What's happening here is that God is explaining, is teaching Cain how, this is how it works. Here's the deal. Okay? Life is like this. Sometimes you're going to get what you want. Sometimes you cannot. Sometimes you'll succeed. There's nothing to be devastated about. Okay? If you do well, whatever the definition of doing well is, you'll be accepted. And if you don't do well, now you've got to watch out. Sin here is sort of personified as this creature crouching at the door. It's a threat. It's sitting there waiting for you to lose your sense of self. Okay? And as soon as you lose your sense of self, there's a mechanism here. Sin comes. Okay? And it can bring you down. How does that work? Why is it that when we lose our sense of self, we're more likely to sin?
Ego.
Okay, so one aspect of it is control. We said from the beginning, we quoted that thing about somebody who cannot rule over himself is like a breached city without a wall. Okay, but I think there's something. And how does he respond? How does Cain respond to that?
He's unwilling to do that.
Yeah. Okay, Cain sees that God rejected his sacrifice, and he says, and think about how many times we've seen this, right? You see this in kids all the time. He says to himself, well, look, if I'm garbage, you think I'm garbage? I'll show you what it means that I'm garbage, okay? I'll show you by acting like garbage, okay? If you lower your sense of self, you then take that image as the standard by which you should be behaving. And you reaffirm it by doing the bad deed that matches that low self-image, okay? It's like, you know, it's like a kid, right? Who his parents praise his sister, so he goes and, like, smacks her. Right? Well, what? And she says, what do you smack me for? And he goes, huh? He walks away, right? I mean, like, that happens all the time. Okay, it happens because the kid is saying, okay, you guys treat me like garbage, I'm going to act like garbage, and I'm going to do it by taking down the thing that you praised. I'm going to bring everybody down. That's my way of reasserting myself in a negative way, in a bad way. And that whole mechanism, right, and it's a self-propelling deterioration that people go through. That's what's going on in these tiny, tiny verses right here. So God gives Cain the choice. He says, you can do this. And Cain doesn't learn from it. He goes the other way. He says, No, I'm going to take the whole world down with me.
Do you think that this story can serve as an apt metaphor for the Palestinians who felt rejected?
I don't know. I'm going to go as far as to say that I do believe that this psychological challenge that individuals face, is also faced by cultures.
Also faced by?
By cultures and collectives.
Very good.
Okay? There is such a thing as a culture convincing itself, and we see this in the whole first story of the Israelites in the desert. That is the story. Where they collectively convince themselves. They've been slaves all their lives. Maybe they were born with this conviction. But they collectively believe themselves incapable of rising and taking responsibility. And that is a collective cultural development. Call it a collective sin, collective punishment, whatever it is, from that standpoint. But from our sort of anthropological standpoint, we see it as a collective cultural narrative of we are victims. We are congenitally incapable of taking responsibility and building, and we're going to act that way. We're not going to expect great things of ourselves.
Able to provide.
Yeah, when you don't provide for us, we're going to say, why? What, just raised out here to kill us in the desert? Wish we'd gone back there, but someone was taking care of us.
Right.
Here's the response. Here's the famous punchline of the story. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Okay, look at this. Look at the spiritual disposition required to say, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Yes. And he said, what have you done? Right, he doesn't answer the question. The question is not in need of answering. He just says, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries to me from the ground. And now cursed are you from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall not yield to you her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shall you be on the earth. The story goes on, if you recall. The king says, okay, well, you know, maybe someone will kill me. So he says, okay, you're worried someone's going to kill you? I'll put a mark on your head. Nobody, right? The mark of Cain, nobody can kill him. Hey, everybody, nobody can kill Cain. He's got to wander. Okay? It's worse than just dying. Okay? And his response, but someone's going to kill me, right? Instead of saying, oops, or I'm going to change, or I'm going to fix everything. No, he says, someone's going to kill me. Like that's God's problem? Should have thought of that, huh? Okay, you know what? Fine. No one's going to kill you. Better? But there's a little bit more going on here. He can't be a farmer anymore. Okay, even this sort of state of endemic mediocrity that he had lived in before, in which he's a mere farmer, not one of these, you know, favored, beloved shepherds, he can't even do that anymore. He's dehumanized. Has no profession. Okay, in the ancient world, wandering around was probably a lot more dangerous than it is today, although it's not that great today either. And what does he look like? Right? Who else wanders? Right? He's almost a mirror image of the shepherd. Right? He's like the black Spider-Man. Right? There's like the red Spider-Man who's the good one, and then there's like the black Spider-Man. Okay? That's Cain. He's the mirror image of the shepherd who can roam the deserts completely responsible, completely self-sufficient, has freedom and spiritual space. This guy is also roaming in the exact opposite way.
Okay? He's homeless.
He's a nomad. Well, he's a nomad. He's a no man. So this is all of a sudden we have this story of the individual. This looks like such a different story from the story of the Israelites wandering in the desert, right? Except that the punishment is the same because the sin is the same. The sin is not simply the murder. Again, I hate to say it, but there's just a lot of murders in the Bible, in the ancient world in general, and only some of them are picked out as being particularly heinous or worthy of extended discussion and specifically bizarre punishments. Right? We talked about the sin of the murder of Ahab. We talked about King David's particular form of murder. Cain's form of murder is unique. It's because it's so bound up in this dehumanization of himself. Okay? This deflation of the spirit that is a moral failing.
But doesn't it also have to do with the covenant?
Explain.
The sin here was caused. The sin was that first of all he would not accept that somebody was more beloved than he was, and he would not allow this to go on. And he said, okay, if I'm suffering, then you're going to die. You're out of the picture. I'm going to just get rid of you, and that way, maybe he thought he'd be able to be in that position.
Or at least psychologically, he would, you know, sort of like Oedipally replace the favor. But it reasserts your sense of self and control.
Yeah,
right?
Well, of course, the action
okay.
itself.
The action
is
saying, I feel completely a loss of control, a loss of self, a loss of confidence, so I'm going to do something, anything, to make me be again.
But it comes from this, that he wasn't willing to accept that there was somebody who was doing better than you. There was somebody who was more successful than you. There was somebody who was more appreciated.
Exactly. That's the covenant.
That's the covenant.
He couldn't accept himself.
Period.
Okay? We act, coveting is a failure to accept yourself. Okay? What do the rabbis say about wealth, about a rich person? Who is rich?
The
person is happy with his own lot, right? Okay, so we have something going on here that's about insecurity. But insecurity not simply as a clinical problem, as a health issue, but as a fundamental, powerful moral failing. Now I'm going to go a little bit further. I'm going to assert that in the ancient Israelite view, in the biblical view, when I say biblical again, especially for the benefit of those of you listening at home, the biblical view I'm referring to the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. In the biblical view, it is a meta-sin. Insecurity is a source of many, many other kinds of sin. The sin behind sin. Now, I want to step aside for a minute and talk about, just for a few moments, about sort of these competing views as to what is the meta-sin. Okay, in various traditions. For example, classic Christian thought sees the meta-sin, finds it in the word temptation. Okay? Temptation is the meta-sin in classical Christian thought. You know, there's this sort of thing pulling me to do the wrong thing, and I have to fight it off. Okay? It's Satan, it's the rabbis call it Yetzer Hara. There's a thing that tempts me. The tempter, right? Even the word Satan, which appears almost not at all in the Bible, okay, barely exists at all. In later thought, both Jewish and Christian, becomes inflated into this force in the universe, right, that pulls you to sin. And of course, they do look as the ultimate story. They look at the story of Adam and Eve, right? They even call it the original sin. Okay, now, I don't know. I don't read the story that way at all. The story of Adam and Eve, we can maybe another time take that story and spread it out and have it out over whether this is really a story about sin. But I find it very hard to believe that, despite the fact that there is a punishment there, I believe there's an exile, and at the same time, what did they do that was so bad? They ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They were stories that open the Bible, are deep philosophical teachings about the nature of the relationships between man, God, and the universe. We said that over and over again. Creation is like that. Adam and Eve is like that. We don't really have people until Cain and Abel. And we don't have sin until Cain and Abel. Okay, so I don't believe that the Bible sees temptation, which, again, isn't really there. The word temptation, right, in Christianity is the Lord's Prayer. You know, lead me not to temptation. That's New Testament. Okay, the Old Testament doesn't talk about temptation.
But the sin in the Garden of Eden was disobedience.
Perhaps.
We were told directly, you may not eat of this tree. You can eat of all the trees you want.
Very complicated story. Because there's also the question of why didn't they die? But maybe they did because they became immortal. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult story. And we're not gonna nail it in this session. Okay? But what I will go out on a limb and say is it's not about temptation. I reject the Christian reading of that story because it's not the ultimate story about sin. If it were, they would call it a sin there and not in Cain and Abel. There's another, our culture has, however, another meta-sin that we have to contend with, and we have to understand what's going on. If we're talking about looking at this within our own world, we understand that there's this sort of Christian teaching that says it's about temptation. There's another Western teaching. Let's say that it comes from the Greek philosophers. Okay, there's a belief that goes like this. You know what the real source of all the bad things in this world is? Ignorance.
What?
Ignorance. A lack of sufficient reason. Okay, if we only were to invest in making everybody more reasonable people, invest in their education, invest in universal philosophical teaching, enlightenment, we would overcome the fundamental problems of the human condition. This is another very powerful cultural force. What I'm suggesting tonight is that alongside the Christian view, the temptation is the source of all evil, alongside, from the other end, the call it, I don't know, continental enlightenment view, that lack of education and insufficient reason is the source of all evil, comes the Hebrew Bible with a completely different view. Rejects both of these and says, no, the source of all evil, but that doesn't
allowing
go far enough. Loss of self-control doesn't go far enough, because what's there when you're not in control? I mean, a child is not in control. When you say you're not in control, it's because he's jumping around and, like, you know, he's going to knock something over, himself over, all right? He's indulging, okay? Indulging in temptations is what you're almost there, almost getting at. No, because if you believe that temptation is the problem, then what you're saying is the natural mechanisms of life, appetites, right? Sexual appetites and culinary appetites and appetites for wealth, these natural things, these are the source of all of our failings. And if we just put this discipline down, if we just control ourselves with an iron fist, then we'll be okay. I don't believe that that's the biblical view. Okay, the biblical view is more, has a very nuanced and complex attitude towards these natural mechanisms. Sexuality and food and power, wealth, all of these things are both good and, having them both good and bad. Okay, they're part of life, and therefore they can't be denied. Okay, and at the same time, they can't become the sole focus. That's the whole idolatry problem. Okay, so as soon as you say it's really just about self-control, no, because the problem with Cain was not that he lacked discipline. The problem with Cain was that he lacked a spirit of himself, a self-respect. Okay, it wasn't that he didn't know how to say no. It was that there was something making him want to kill in the first place. That was the problem. It's a deeper problem.
Where do you see that? I mean, where in the text is that?
Is what?
What you're suggesting, yeah, that it goes beyond his inability to control himself, when in fact God...
Because whoever said anything about controlling, where is it saying about controlling if you do not do good, right? It says you can overcome sin.
Well
overcome is control.
Yeah. I think what that verse means is, as you said, to use some of your own words, it's life is very difficult and oftentimes unfair. And we want to do things we really shouldn't.
But is the message of how you control yourself about discipline, or is it about your disposition? Is it about the thing that you believe about yourself? Okay, what is it that the Israelites were lacking that caused them to be so scared? Why is it that self-control has to express itself through not being afraid there and through not murdering there? What's driving them to be afraid to murder in the first place? What's missing? Okay, yeah.
It's again, this whole thing is that he offered something that wasn't 100%.
Perhaps.
And he didn't like himself for that. He knew that.
Or maybe he didn't. He did it because he didn't like himself to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then the circumstances. He got jealous of his brother, envious of his brother, because his brother had pure thoughts of giving the best of his flock, where his thoughts weren't to give the best.
With what you're saying, except for the word pure. I don't think it's an issue of purity. Okay.
David,
it's an issue of, one second, a shepherd and a farmer. Okay, just think again about what kind of lives these people live and how they view themselves. A shepherd is independent. Okay, everything he does in life, it's his own decision to do. Where to go, what to eat, or rather when to eat. He's got his food and he's got his clothing. A farmer constantly is beseeching the world, the gods, for rain at the right time and not at the wrong time. He's dependent. He does not have an enormous view of himself. Okay, he can't. And so the God, when it's time to bring something to God, he brings whatever he brings. He doesn't feel great and grand and expansive. Okay? And for some reason, God consistently prefers the shepherd over and over again. Go for it.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting discussion and certainly worthwhile as well.
But.
No, there's a big but. you're doing an awful lot of eisegesis here as opposed to exegesis.
Help everybody else understand what that means.
Yeah.
Reading into the text things that are not there. In other words,
okay,
it's great to psychologize, philosophize. I mean, it asks the question, what was he thinking?
I have a few difficult questions that need answering. One, why is the Tenth Commandment about covenant? Two, why are these two stories that seem totally, utterly disconnected, why are these two crimes punished with the exact same punishment? Okay.
You mean the...
The wilderness, the Israelites in the wilderness versus Cain and Abel. Okay, to me, that's a question that needs answering. Now, could be that you could just say, look,
well, okay,
there's nothing there.
I can try to offer an answer to that, but...
And third, I'm trying to understand, what is it that makes Cain's crime in the context of his crime, the context of the farmer versus the shepherd, the context of God saying this thing and then him ignoring it and just doing the deed. Okay? What is being taught about human nature?
I have this
belief that it's positioning in the story. If this thing had appeared in 2 Kings 27, I might have given it a lot less weight. We're talking about the first story about humanity.
Well, I don't think that's true either. I think the whole first 10 chapters are not real. I mean, they're...
I didn't say anything about real.
They're meant... But anyway...
I made no claims about real.
Yeah. No, you said the first two chapters, and he's the first real man.
In a literary sense. I'm not talking about history.
The story is very rich, and obviously we would all agree on that. And especially, it's so small. It's a tiny story. It's like... I don't know how many verses, and it really can sustain a number of readings. And all I'm saying here is that your reading may be sustained by the text, but there are other readings. And when you say what is it that drove him, or what was his sin, I think the clear statement of the text is that he somehow was not able, as all of us have the same struggle. This is a universal condition of man. All of us struggle.
Who was not able?
Cain was not able.
Cain was not able.
Exactly. That's right.
So, and I think that, to me, the text is pretty clear about
the struggle of what? Finish the sentence.
What? Yeah, you didn't finish it.
Was not able to deal with his impulses and control himself.
Do you have those impulses?
Yes.
Yes.
To kill people?
But what's behind that?
No, honestly.
Label, what's behind that lack of self-control? There's something that originates, there's an origination that triggers the struggle with this control. In other words, we're feeling anger, do we have self-control?
Yes, there's anger, there's
behind,
envy.
I want to know what's behind those things.
I understand. So there's a lot of things. Could be anger, could be envy. Could be no sense of self.
All of those things are the same.
All these things, I understand.
But they're all the same thing. They're not many different things.
Okay. The text doesn't. All I'm saying is the text does not hint at that. This is our reading into the text, and that's okay. We can do that.
I think there is no louder hint you could possibly ask for. Than the comparability of the punishments of two radically different cases. I would say
the punishment is connected in this way, that the important thing here about the punishment is that the Torah is making a statement about the connection between the moral life and the natural nature itself. That is, man's moral state is reflected by nature. And that is to say that Adam and Eve's punishment was, whereas they had everything available to them in the Garden of Eden, from now on it's only by the sweat of your brow. And the earth shall, even by the sweat of your brow, shall yield only thorn and thistle. And the next thing that happens is this. And here, even with all the work in the world, not even thorn and thistle will it yield.
You have to,
and when the Torah continues with this, v'hayayim shamoa, in the Shema, if you're good, the rains will come in season. Your flocks will multiply and you will prosper. And if you're not good, There'll be no rain, and your flocks are gonna are gonna disappear. So there is a connection between morality and how the earth itself.
I want to understand that.
Okay, and here with and the sin, the sin of the spies is that you can't go to the promised land because.
Okay, but by that definition, every sin should be punished with wandering. Okay, here there's only two of them. There's only two. Only these two stories. Okay, to me that's a very big hint, and it makes me push on. But let's hear a few other people. Yeah.
I'm not trying to
express. Go for it. Come on.
So
assert yourself. Expand.
So Adam and Eve were punished because they attained knowledge, and they were punished to go and pretty much be themselves. Like if you're defined, if you become more defined by having a profession, like they were slaves because they didn't have sense of themselves.
Who were slaves? The Israelites?
The Israelites were slaves because they didn't have a sense of themselves, so they didn't have anything. They were just slaves. Mm-hmm. So like, if God was telling them to have a sense of themselves by being able to have some control of their lives, wasn't he kind of doing the same thing to Adam and Eve? He was like, yes, you're going to have to sweat for your own self, but you'll kind of be making your own self because you'll have the ability to have freedom of choice.
Look, I think so. I think the story of Adam and Eve is a story of origins. It is, how did human beings end up so different from all the other animals? Okay? Remember, there's something kind of funny, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Did they get free will at that point? Well, it can't be that they got free will, because they didn't have free will before, that they couldn't have disobeyed. They couldn't have disobeyed. So they had free will already. And what they wanted was what they ate of was the tree of ambition, the tree of change, the tree of things can be different than they are. And wow, as soon as you are a creature that believes things can be different than they are, okay, then you're already kind of like God, which is interesting, right? Beforehand we were already created in the image of God. Okay, we just didn't know it. Okay, then we ate the food, we realized it, and God says, okay, wait, if we stay in this sense of, you know, he's going to eat from the tree of life, he's going to live forever, and then he will be indistinguishable from a god. By the way, there's another story where man is kind of almost like challenging God, and as a result gets exiled.
Right?
The Tower of Babel. Right? Just a few chapters later, we have another story where man challenges, you know, and by the way, there too, they don't even say, let's be evil, let's be better than God. They just say, let's build a tower to the heavens. You know, and God says, right? On the one hand, it's in human nature to be somewhat godlike. And on the other hand, it's a dangerous thing as well. And it puts us in positions where we can't just live and die and merge with the cycle of nature. We're outside of nature. We're doing something, you know, that we have this moral realm. Okay, that's going, you know, yes.
I want to say something. I see this as being a story about coveting, but coveting that brings you to an action that you're not allowed to take. And the punishment here is much, much worse than the punishment of the Israelites, because the Israelites, it was in their case, they were being punished, but their children had hope. Here...
He gets children. Cain gets children.
And they're not
bad about? No, they're fine. You're okay. There's even like this other guy a few generations later who says, you know, look, I killed somebody, and the Tuval Cain, I killed somebody, and if Cain was punished for, you know, seven times over, 77 times, yeah, he's got kids, they're funny. Some of them have some of the Mishigas of their ancestors. It goes on. Yeah. Was the Garden of Eden really, really good place to live?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sounds okay to me.
Yeah.
Well, we often say this must be paradise when we're having a good time.
I once visited a very wealthy man in San Diego. I'd never met him before. Okay, extremely wealthy man, and I went to, you know, I was like representing some nonprofit organization. I show up, and he like opens his door, comes outside, and says, "Welcome to Gun Eden." So yeah, maybe, you know. He bought his house.
I had that same experience.
Yeah?
Maybe the same guy. I don't know. I'm not kidding.
We'll compare notes.
Was it in San Diego?
Have you felt
Wait, it's the tip of the spear. Okay, but if this thing going crazy.
There's something so perfect. In one ending, everything is there.
According to the Bible, according to the literary structure of what's going on, isn't it impossible to achieve? Isn't it against their nature to be there? Isn't that why they were kicked out? Because it was against their nature to be there?
To be there?
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means when you say to be there. What does that mean?
That was what they
you mean to be in that state all the time?
Were they ejected?
I haven't been able to be in that state all the time, so that's all I have. I just have my own experience. Mm-hmm. But with work, you can be feeling that completion in self more often than maybe not, with understanding the subtleties that happen. All of these things that are explained here are things that happen to us all the time. The insecurity of this or that. How do we relate once we're feeling insecure? Do we negate it? Do we try to push it away by pissing off somebody because we feel uncomfortable with it? Or do we allow it to be there and sit with it and transcend it, to allow it to just to work itself out without, but feeling that uncomfortability?
I think there's a big.
That's.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with you or not. Honestly, I think that there's a really enormous question that has just been put on the table, which we're not going to solve tonight, but which is worthy of its own huge discussion, which is the Garden of Eden something to strive for? Or is it something that it's important to reject in our minds? I don't know.
Yes, we could continue. It's very interesting. Again, the whole idea of meta-sin, which you said in Christianity, temptation, and then you talked about ignorance, and then you offered the biblical...
insecurity, yeah, for lack of a better word.
Okay, what about for instance, pride? And what I would call the Muslim ideal, which is submission. That's the highest good, is to be able to submit, which means basically to recognize that there is something much greater than you, beyond you, outside of you. And unlike Buddhism, where the idea is to merge into that and to become one, to become the one with the one and the one, in Islam, the idea is to submit.
Look, Islam calls it submitting. Okay, I'm going to be really hugely generalizing here because I do recognize the subtleties of the differences. But from a Hebrew biblical perspective, there's an Islam, right, which is submission, right? Okay, submission to God, right? You've got Catholicism. I'm using Catholicism as a placeholder for classical Christianity as a whole, of course, which is grace. Right, self-denial to turn yourself into a vessel. Okay, you've got Confucianism, right, which is about turning yourself into. Remember, we talked about the Chinese dancers, right? Turning yourself, positioning yourself in the right place in society, so that all society works like a machine, which is also gonna bring you familiar within various forms of communism as well, which is like it's all one organic body, right? You've got Platonism, right, which is the denial of the body and saying, you know, emerging with the ideal forms and the philosophical thing, okay? All of these different ancient traditions are pushing you from a Hebrew biblical perspective to say this thing which we've called, this thing which we call self, that starts with our bodies and expands outwards to include our stuff, right, and our friends, and our parents, right, and our kids, right, that thing that expands outward and it's the community, okay, this constant effort to differentiate me from the rest, wherever that border is, okay, all of these things are denying that, are attacking me. Right. All of them. Right. They're all saying the self is an illusion.
That's right.
It's a source of wickedness, it's a source of evil. Okay, and the Bible is saying, no, there is you, and it's real, okay?
And it's good.
And it needs to be developed and built, okay?
You want to piss off
But
you want to piss off
But when you take
self, you could make an argument that when you take self or the idealization of self and putting self above everything else, if you take that to the extreme, then you will want to have more than anybody else. You might want to, and that's the coveting.
It doesn't even have to go to be extreme.
That's the coveting. Yes. It's the idolatry. It's the sin of Elijah, right?
What you've been portraying over the past couple of weeks is that self is expansion and it's redemptive and it's doing good. Yes. Whereas self, if you put more emphasis on self than on community, for example, it could lead you to being antisocial. It could lead you to being
selfish.
Selfish, yes.
Okay.
And to not want anybody to be more than you, okay. Which becomes
common. Look, we have a real problem with a lot of these words. Okay, words like pride have this incredible dual meaning. Okay, it has a very negative meaning and a very positive meaning in English, yeah. Also in Hebrew, right? Gava, spoken like in Israeli, is a good word. Okay, in a rabbinic Ashkenazic tone, it becomes gaiva. Which is a very bad thing. Okay? Excessive pride, to use the phrase excessive pride, doesn't help us at all. It's a way of distinguishing it from good pride. Okay? These words, self, selfish, selfless, they're very confusing because Western culture has absorbed conflicting ideas. Okay? We are a civilization that is both Hebraic and Greek. And Christianity sort of trying to mix them both together. And so we get these words that we just toss them out, and it turns out that the pride can be great or awful, that the self can be great or awful. I'm trying to find a way to separate out this language, okay, by saying that there's actually, in the Hebrew biblical view, excessive pride isn't from a good, serious, healthy sense of self.
Yeah.
It comes from a messed up lack of a sense of self. Okay? Deep down inside, when you do bad things, it reflects your self-image. You've convinced yourself that you're the kind of person that does bad things. Okay? And you then go and do more bad things in order to reaffirm that image.
Well, you don't think about it at all.
I'm not saying it's conscious. I'm not saying it's conscious.
No, but
okay? This stuff often happens unconsciously. Okay? Often it's unthinking. Okay, you go around, you say, that person, who looks like they're doing great in life, I bet they've got a lousy marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you justify good things happening to other people by taking them down. Well, why would you do that such a thing? Why not just be really happy with what they've got? Why not say, hey, you look great today? Because you're threatened. You're threatened by other people's success. Okay, this is a mechanism. We know it. We just haven't figured out how to apply it to our bizarre vocabulary that's so deeply influenced by conflicting traditions about the self and pride and health and all these things. Okay? So what I'm trying to do is help us sort of divide these things out and perhaps even argue for our own traditional view as to how to approach these problems. When you go through these commandments and you ask yourself, okay, where does insecurity, how does it work? Okay, how is it? Well, if you're insecure, you're not going to believe that you are the person to go and change the world. You're not going to believe that you can intervene and make things better. You're going to believe, like the slaves, that somebody else has to take care of the problems. You're going to be embittered rather than expansive. Okay, when you're insecure, you're going to look for easy answers. Okay, you're going to say, I want to feel good by attaching myself to the powerful, by attaching myself to the beautiful, instead of just saying, I'm okay as I am. When you're insecure, okay, you're going to feel like I have to falsify in order to establish myself. Right? You're going to create the circumstances in which lying becomes the thing that you do. You're not going to admit your faults in public. Right? You're going to act like Saul rather than David. Right? When you're insecure, you're not going to invest time and effort in yourself because you don't like yourself. You're not going to want to spend time, you know, expecting great things of you. When you're insecure, right, you're going to reject your parents because you're going to blame them for your flaws. Deep down inside, you're going to say, I don't want what they have to give me because what they gave me is already bad enough. Right? When you're insecure, you're going to be like Cain. Okay? You're going to reject the value of life as something really precious and important. When you're insecure, you can't love properly and expand and include others because you don't love yourself. Right? Same thing here. You're not going to respect other people's property and other people's freedom. You're going to resent it. You're going to resent it. You're going to covet what they have. You're going to say they don't deserve what they got. Okay? You're not certainly not going to want to expand and embrace a community. Because who am I? What right do I have to benefit and who am I to get up and make things better for others? Okay, this is what I mean by the medicine. Now you could come from the Catholic view and say, no, it's about all these things are temptations. Okay? Or you could come from the modern Enlightenment view and say all these things have to do with ignorance. Okay, but I believe that the Ten Commandments are saying, and this is why it appears here at the end. At the end, in a place where it's sort of like this exclamation point, covering the entirety, right? Doubling back as this book ends, right? But remembering the Fourth Commandment and the assertion of the self, a structure that's revealing itself before us right now. Okay? At the beginning, I said that I don't really buy this five and five thing. Right, I mentioned that, right? I don't buy the five and five. The first tablet, the second tablet. Okay, I admit, it's a flaw in the overall picture. It would be nice and perfect if my structure went five commandments on one tablet, five commandments on another tablet. There are 10 commandments. But I do see a structure in them. Okay, one is I am the Lord. 2 through 5, adultery, oath, Sabbath, and parents. 6 through 9, we did last week, murder, adultery, theft, and false witness. In one breath, one verse, and then 10 is coveting. Okay? There's the idea of redemption that is the groundwork for all of the 10 commandments and the value behind it. Okay? There are values, things that we build around ourselves and build ourselves through, right? The concept of morality, the concept of truthfulness and integrity, affirmation of the self, and the idea of human wisdom, okay? Then you have goals, really, within our world, right? We go from just sort of focusing on us to focusing on our interactions with the world, the affirmation of life, the affirmation of love, the giving other people room, right? Sort of restricting our expansion to make it possible to have a society, and then the society itself in the form of community. And then we double back to a spiritual claim. But if you want to do all of that, if you want this whole package, okay, then you need to have a spiritual disposition, an inner peace, that is the ultimate expression of which, or the paradigmatic expression of its violation, is the ban on coveting. Okay, you need to be the kind of person that never covets. All right, and that's what you need in order to get everything else.
But that's not human.
Isn't it?
What's not human?
Okay.
It's not human to say, I'll never covet. It's not human. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
Say, Tim, you don't
yes.
say
no,
that.
Way,
no, ridiculous.
I love this.
It's ridiculous.
Them's fighting words.
No, it's ridiculous to say, you must have inner peace. Like, how can you, you know, you can say, you should strive for inner peace. You must. But to say you have to have inner peace, it's like either you are
without it,
you can't have inner peace because you say I want inner peace. It's
you have to strive for it.
Yeah, I mean,
striving for it doesn't mean you always achieve it.
Good, okay, but well, you
know,
the problem that I have with coveting is you can say, okay, I don't like what I'm feeling right now, I'm going to try to get beyond it. But why should you be punished, or why should you feel that there's something wrong with the fact that you're feeling it?
You could not have made a better transition for me to what I'm about to talk about if I'd paid you.
See, there's a conspiracy.
There's a conspiracy of course.
Yeah. God works okay. In
the clack.
There's an epilogue to all of this.
There's what?
An epilogue. Okay.
Yes.
An afterword, if you're for those of you keeping score at home. Which is that this package looks like a wonderful ideal. It competes against other competing ideals. Except for one funny thing about the Bible. And it's important. Which is that, you know, the Bible is a really long book. Okay? It's really, really long. It's a lot longer than the New Testament. A lot longer than the Republic of Plato. It's a lot longer than the Communist Manifesto. Certainly, the Universal Declaration of Rights, Rousseau's Emile, any of these philosophical books about what is really great, they tend to be quite short. And the Hebrew Bible is long and full of really of a lot of nasty stuff. Nasty, nasty stories. Drama and sin. It's almost as if everything I'm saying is all good and well, so why don't we just say that? Right? There's a famous rabbinic statement that talks about the four people who died because of the bite of the serpent from the Garden of Eden. Okay? And these four people are like these totally minor figures. Right? Jesse, the father of David, I think is one. Okay? These like non-players are the four people who essentially died without sin. That's the interpretation. Four people who died. Why did they die? Because of this, of the bite of the serpent. In other words, they died without sin, for no reason at all. That's what the understanding of that rabbinic tale is. Everybody else sinned. All of these people in the Bible are very imperfect. All of them. Right? None of them are the Buddha. Right? None of them, Elijah probably sort of went up to heaven and didn't die. I don't know. We don't really know about that. But none of them are the ideal. None of them. Every single one of them, every single great figure in the Bible is flawed. Seriously flawed. Of course, the story where this comes through is the story of Noah. Okay? What's the story of Noah, right? We've talked about it before. God says, not very wisely at this point in the character development of the Lord, he says, this whole world really stinks. It really, really stinks. It's full of, what's the word?
Kamas.
Right? Which means whatever it means, probably thievery. But it's gross, whatever it is. And he says, I'm going to start over, destroys the whole world, takes the best person there is, Noah. And Noah, quite reasonably, survives the flood, goes out, and quite reasonably gets himself drunk.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay? But that's, okay, but the first thing he does before he gets himself good and drunk is he, you know, the descendant of wonderful vegetarians, slays himself some meat and serves it up, and God says, and I think we talked about this before, but we have to take a look at it again, right? And Noah built an altar to the Lord, and he took of every pure beast and every pure fowl and brought offerings on the altar, and the Lord smelled the savory scent, and the Lord said in his heart, never again shall I curse the earth because of man, for the inclination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Never again shall I destroy all life as I have done. How nice. I'm never going to do this again because you're bad, so I'm never going to do this again. Okay.
It's not going to help anyway.
It's not going to help anyone. Look, maybe. It seems that way. I mean, God made him, you know. He regretted. God, he even says, I regret it. There are different times when he says, I regret it that I made man. Okay. Nobody ever said God was perfect. Okay, some people.
Yeah, that was a sweet one line.
Slipped it in when we weren't looking.
Now we have later.
Wait, before we get to this, okay, the rabbis have this great story. Okay, so Moses goes up to heaven, right? He's on that top Mount Sinai, and among the various things he does while the Israelites are down below looking at their watches and saying, where's this guy? Right, Moses is up there, he goes up to heaven, and he meets the angels. Did I tell you this already?
Yes.
I told you it again. Okay, so we'll say it again. I'll say it briefly. Okay, he meets the angels, and the angels say, what is this human doing here? Right? Remember this? What is this human doing here? What is this child of woman doing among us? And he says to them, and God says to them, he's come to receive the Torah. And they said, your precious secret you've kept hidden for 974 generations before the creation of the universe, and now you plan to give it to one of flesh and blood? And God says to Moses, answer them. Okay, I have to retell it, because we've seen so much since the first time I told it. God says to Moses, answer them. And Moses says, I'm afraid to answer, lest they burn me with their breath. And God says, hold on to my throne and give them an answer. Moses says, Master of the universe, what does the Torah that you gave me say? I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. He says to the angels, did you go down to Egypt? To Pharaoh? Were you enslaved? Why do you need the Torah? What else does it say? You shall have no other gods. Are you among the nations who worship idols? What else does it say? Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. Do you toil that you need to rest? What else does it say? You shall not take the name of the Lord in vain. Do you have business dealings? What else? By the way, that's another proof that it's talking about false oaths, right? Why would you have business dealings mean anything if it was about just saying, you know, God's name? What else does it say? Honor your father and your mother. Do you have a father and a mother? What else does it say? You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. Do you have jealousy among you or the evil urge? And immediately they conceded to God. Okay, this incredible story emphasizing the fallibility of human nature as being it's not that we have to concede to our failings. It's not just a realistic view of what we can achieve. Those failings are of the essence of who we are. They are the reason why we get the Ten Commandments, why the Ten Commandments make any sense at all. Okay, so as opposed to other traditions that very well may look for that perfection, presume that perfection, throw you into a situation of original sin, where all of human existence is prima facie sinful, and all you can hope for is that you get the grace of God that you don't deserve. As opposed to that, the Bible is saying, no, we need a view of right and wrong, of good and evil, that begins with and embraces the fallibility of human nature. So everything that we set up till now is, if anything I say is misinterpreted as, here's the assumption, you can be perfect, then we've missed it. Okay, that's what I think is really going on here in Deuteronomy. For the commandment that I give you this day, it is not beyond you. This is exactly what Stephen's saying. Nor is it far away. Not is it far away. Typos. Great. See, fallibility. Nor is it far away. It is not in heaven that you may say, who will go up to heaven and bring it to us and we will do it? Nor is it across the sea that you may say, who will cross the sea for us and bring it to us? Then he may listen. For the thing, the davar, is very near to you, on your lips and in your heart, that you may do it. Okay? It's something for us, for real people. Fallible, lousy people that you know, are saved from the flood that God brings to destroy everything. What do? They become meat eaters and drunkards that are saved from, you know, by dozens of miracles from slavery in Egypt, and all they can do is whine about how good things used to be, because they haven't found themselves yet. That's what this book is about. That's who it's for. Okay? And it's about accepting where we are and embracing where we are and who we are and trying to take steps forward that are not impossible, that are not simply, you know, beautiful, pristine teachings that somehow involve a repudiating fundamental truths about our nature. Okay? I believe that the reason that this works is because this is real. This is what people are really like. This is more in tune with the fundamental realities of human nature, in my humble opinion, than what these other competing traditions have to offer. And that's why we survive. Okay, that's my closing assertion to leave you with. I just put this here because I thought it was really cool. I just found it online. I thought it was really cool. There's this artist who does all these bizarre kind of renderings of various biblical stories. It was also the one I showed you before for Cain and Abel. I thought it was kind of neat. Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
I still don't get it.
Okay.
Why? You once talked about bookends.
Bookends.
Right. And the 10th one was the end. Thou shalt not covet.
Right.
Is the closing one.
Yeah.
According to the chart you had up a few moments ago, I could not see the second bookend. I understand why redemption's first, and I don't understand why coveting is last.
Why is coveting last?
I mean, I would assume that there's some kind of build-up here that's leading to the precipice, to the top of the mountain.
I think there is.
And you haven't told us yet.
I think there is.
Or maybe you have. I missed it.
I can try to express it. I think that what the reason this is last is because it is... I don't think we would have understood it fully. Its importance, if it had been earlier. Because what we're saying is, what I'm suggesting is, again, it's the peak of a mountain that looks very small when you get to it. Mm-hmm. Okay, and only when you stand on it and look around you and start thinking about your way down the mountain do you understand what you've achieved. I believe that it is very difficult to understand the importance of the inner peace without understanding all the different steps that we've had up till now. Okay, it would have been one other... it would be hard to understand why it's important for life and love and all of these different things. That's my sense. If you have an opening statement about being in history, mm-hmm. that is, once we get to the end of it, that thing looks... almost shallow, you know, almost young and idealistic, right? I'm going to go out and change the world. Okay, now let's talk about that world a little bit. Let's talk about what changing that world really means. Okay, we're young and idealistic back in the first commandment. By the time you get to the 10th commandment, we've been through an awful lot. Okay, and sometimes, you know, getting to that might be, on the one hand, it turns out that it's the precondition for going back and really changing things. On the other hand, it's also...
So really, it should be either first or second.
It's also an achievement. It's also an achievement. It's something that is... You can only really understand how hard it is when you've understood what idolatry is and what integrity is required for an investment in self. All of these different steps, which are... On the one hand, it's both a precondition, which is why I did the circular thing, but on the other hand, it's also an achievement in its own right. And it's a very, very difficult one, as other people have mentioned. If you're interested in, I've been publishing occasional pieces on the weekly Torah reading. If you recall, we talked about we talked about the binding of Isaac, and that I wasn't sure what I meant by it. Okay, I ended up actually saying what I said there in what I published. Steve has been putting them up on Israel Scene, but if you'd like to get it by email, please pass your emails to Anat, and I'll make sure that you're on the list. Yeah.
Just a comment about the expulsion from the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, let's do that.
A little talk here that we had about the return to the Garden of Eden. And of course, that's been a very powerful theme in all of, certainly, Western tradition. And even in our own tradition, the Jewish tradition, the whole idea of Tikkun Olam is to create here what it was that we lost there.
Not only that, also the rabbinic tradition says that if you do well, you go to Gan Eden, right? That's the Hebrew word for paradise or for heaven that you go to after you die is right. The Garden of Eden. But it's not in the Bible. Just
okay, but our responsibility, yeah. According to the rabbis, is to work hard to create here what we had there. But this idea, of course, was picked up Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, in a literary tradition of many people.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is that Freud also used this whole idea that the birth of a child is an expulsion into a hard, cold reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the infant awakens to that reality with a cry, with a sputter when he's slapped to get mm-hmm. the amniotic fluid out. And here, Eden was this perfect environment, the mm-hmm. womb, which...
Right.
So that all of life, according to Freud, is an attempt, one way or another, to recreate the conditions we first experienced as fetus in the womb. And what we do all of our life, in some way or another, is try to find our way back to that paradise which was lost.
Yeah, I think that...
He was more Jewish than he admitted to.
Oh, every Jew is more Jewish than he admits.
What's that?
Every Jew is more Jewish than he admits.
Probably. Well, actually, there are a lot of Jews who are not as Jewish as they say they are. So.
But in that, they are also more Jewish than they admit. look, in many ways, that dovetails with what I was saying about insecurity, right? You can. Another way to describe what I'm describing about insecurity is, I mean, what is more insecure than a baby who's just been born? Okay, the need for that inner peace as a, you know, Freud would say it's a goal, and in many ways what I'm saying is it's a precondition for goodness, is the sense of that I'm okay. That I'm okay, that I'm thinking I'm okay that we once had, that we know we once had. Okay, so what Freud is saying is you know, I'm striving for, you know, for something that I don't have. I'm coveting that original, primordial paradise. And that may well be, but not everybody seems to act that way. Right? Only some people seem to act that way. Mostly people who end up, and I would say a disproportionate number of the people who end up in psychoanalysis or in any psychological therapy are people that for one reason or another feel something is lacking and it's affecting their functioning.
That's good.
Okay? But there are other people who are doing okay, or that they're, or put it another way, doing okay in some aspects of life and less okay in other aspects of life. So there is such a thing as a healthy, and I would say perhaps they're already achieving that paradise. They're already there. And that's that self, that's that inner peace that I'm describing, perhaps. There's a problem with, in general, with psychological theory, which is that it disproportionately addresses people who are unhealthy at the expense sometimes of people who don't suffer from the things because they're not really examining them that well.